All right, everybody, eyes front. It's another episode of No Coast Cinema. I am your co-host, Connor Cornelius, joined, if you've been paying attention, for the second consecutive week, Lise Graham.
Hello, how's it going, Connor?
Doing great. How are you today?
I'm good. I'm like, now I'm switched up. So last week I was with Tom, now I'm with you.
Yep.
So next week I'll be by myself.
Yep, exactly. Tom and I are going through some difficulties right now with each other. He needed to take a break.
Yeah, he did. So I'm kind of like a mediator.
So what we're going to be talking about today, we have a great show. We have Aaron Ska and Shay Hardacre from the Octastash production company, creators of the web series Collective Failures. It's a great show. We're going to be interviewing with them. But first, we got a little bit of news from around the cinema world. Here on NoCo Cinema, your guide to cinema here in Chicago, as well as all around the world. If you guys have your globes out, just go over to South America. In Venezuela, there's been a little bit of trouble there economically and
a lot
of things, obviously. But, you know, living in the United States, you get a little bit... You get a little bit like suckered into the culture here, and you sort of forget that there are, you know, entertainment cultures in other countries. Venezuela has one. However, it has been struggling a little bit as of late. And again, sort of going off of that idea with the scarcity or with being like stuck in the United States, you don't really think of certain things. You take it sort of for granted, right? Like you can go to the grocery store and get like a loaf of bread, but bread is a very scarce commodity in Venezuela nowadays. Like it's such a cornerstone of the film going experience as well, and popcorn has actually become scarce in Venezuela, and that's just like the most trivial of the problems. Obviously bread scarcity isn't trivial, but not being able to eat popcorn while you're going to a movie is not that huge of a deal. But there are a lot of things going on in that country that are making it very difficult to be a part of the entertainment industry. There have been over 3 months of anti-government protests where police have had to gas malls, which is where, you know, a lot of the cinemas are in these malls, and it's affected, you know, young, like children, and it's affecting adults and everything. Obviously, Venezuela, you might have heard about this, has some of the worst crime in the world. Leads to about 25,000 deaths a year. So people are actually afraid to go out at night. So people don't, you know, people don't go out to the cinema at night because they're afraid of being assaulted. Journalists and reporters at these production companies and at these major studios in Venezuela are afraid of leaving their offices because they're victims of assault and robberies.
Ugh, it's sickening.
Yeah.
I mean, and looking at the numbers, just the numbers of the admissions, this Variety article says admissions were down 35% between 2015 and 2016. And that's a loss of some 10 million admissions. That's crazy.
Yeah, and there are a bunch of factors contributing to that. Obviously, street crime being one of them. DVD piracy is up. So sort of like with the streaming services here, people just kind of want to stay in their homes. Even though movie tickets there range between 50 cents. I mean, they're dirt cheap. And anybody can really afford to go in Venezuela. However, it's obviously a very difficult time in the country's history to be focusing on something like that, but people need to be able to get these stories out. People need to be able to go kind of experience, you know, an escape from the, like, maybe from how harsh the reality of the country is at the moment. Even though they're still making movies, it's not like a simple process as it is here. A lot of the TV stations are now state-owned, and you know, like in the United States, obviously, we are allowed to be outspoken about our government. However, since the TV networks are largely state-owned in Venezuela, the people who are critical of their government, they get shut down.
Yeah, that's rough. But there is hope at the end of this article.
Absolutely.
I see. It reads, the 13th edition of Venezuela's most prominent film festival, the Merida Festival of Venezuelan Cinema, it kept its annual appointment despite some logistical challenges. So it ran from June 11th through the 14th and showcased 17 new Venezuelan films, which is, I mean, that's, you know, still a lot, six of which were world premieres, with Italy as its guest of honor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, it's like, it's times like these when the movies need to be made, really, like, to, you know, get the message out, but it's then the struggle to get it supported. So I guess keep an eye out, watch some Venezuelan film, donate to some production companies that are looking for help. Yeah.
It's a difficult time. But as you said, there is light at the end of the tunnel, and there are a lot of people in the Venezuelan film industry that have nothing but hope going
right.
forward.
Totally.
Now back to the United States.
Yes.
Of course, there is a little bit less of a serious thing going on, but there at the box office this weekend, there is going to be a trifecta of franchises battling it out for the top three spots.
Okay, which ones?
So we got War for the Planet of the Apes, which is the third installment in the rebooted series from the popular cult classic.
I just rolled my eyes. Sorry.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're a fan of these. I haven't seen any of them.
Oh, you haven't seen any of them?
No.
So the first one, I think it was Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
Had James Franco. I liked it, but I didn't think it was that great. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, however, I thought that was amazing.
Really?
Yeah. And it's all done with the motion capture through, I don't know if it's Weta Digital, but it's Andy Serkis, who is, you know, a huge pioneer of that motion capture technique. And he...
is the guy that played Gollum?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he was King Kong in Peter Jackson's adaptation of that movie.
Is that the one that just came out?
No, that was Skull Island.
Oh, I saw that one.
Yeah.
You're talking
King
Jack
Kong
Black
from, yeah, exactly, from 2006.
Right.
And Adrian Brody.
Yeah.
I think that those movies are great. I do, but... War for the Planet of the Apes is also battling out another character, which I think is great, which is Spider-Man. The new.
Oh, for a second, I thought you meant in the movie.
Spider-Man. Oh, yeah. Spider-Man does make an appearance in the.
Does he?
No.
Oh.
Your eyes just so.
Oh, my
I think that that's
a
good idea, though.
Guys. Yeah. Oh, that'd be. I'd pay for that.
War for the Planet of the
Apes.
Apes
versus
Spider-Man. Because.
It's kind of like Batman versus Superman, except hopefully better than that shit.
Yeah, there you go.
I didn't even see it, but I've heard really bad things.
I do think that any movie is improved if you add Of the Apes onto the end.
Yeah.
So there's Spider-Man Homecoming versus War for the Planet of the Apes.
Of the Apes, yeah. It's kind of clunky. I remember when Rise of the Planet?
What do you mean it's clunky?
Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, that is a mouthful.
Like that, I remember when it came out, I was just like, that's stupid because there's too many ofs in that. But I guess it's done it well enough to have, you know, third place. Okay, so we've got that. We've got Spider-Man. And what's the third one?
Rounding it out in third place is another installment in a trilogy, apparently, Despicable Me 3.
Oh, God.
But instead of an E, it's a 3 because, you know, that's cute.
Which E?
It's the final E.
Oh, in me.
Yeah, but whether or not this is the final installment in this franchise...
I doubt it. They're gonna.
That would be merciful, but I don't see it happening.
I've never seen any of these, so maybe I'm missing out on something really great. But yeah. I did see the Minions movie.
Oh God!
Which, not my choice. Mm-hmm. I was babysitting, and the kids were like, "I was like, okay, well, yeah, I'd rather sit in a quiet theater for a couple hours." But
kind of a nightmare that Minions, isn't it?
They're just so dumb.
Yeah.
I just can't. I'm sorry. I know.
It's
well,
like
no,
a dystopia
you're not a fan.
Or something.
It's freaky.
It's sort of like Cars, how there are no people and it's all just like all of the cars have eaten the humans and consumed them or something.
Did you see Cars 3?
I didn't see the third one, no. I've avoided it so far.
That came out a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, right? Have you seen it?
No.
I imagine there would be a line out the door for it, but.
I did not like Cars 1, and so I definitely avoided Cars 2, which sucks because I love Pixar, you know?
Yeah.
But they just messed up on that one.
It's, I don't know.
Anyway.
Larry the Cable Guy. Whatever.
Yeah.
You know? Let's not go down that road.
Oh, God.
The real news here.
Voice in my head. Tomato.
I'm sorry. Mater. No.
Mater.
No.
Okay.
The nightmare is back. The real news here is that these three franchises are just battling it out for the top three in the box office. With original films like Kumail Nanjiani's The Big Sick and...
Chicago-based. Looks awesome.
Love it. Haven't
seen it.
They
were also on Comedy Bang Bang.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I wish that I had more time to go see these original movies, like The Big Sick and Edgar Wright's Baby Driver.
Yeah.
And they're just battling it out for fourth place right now.
That sucks.
Yeah.
I mean, I was thinking this the other day. It's just like, it's crazy how everything's been remade twice, three mm-hmm. times. I mean, even like Spider-Man, it's like
third
in
reboot.
Our lifetime, mm-hmm. we've seen it rebooted three times. And are you 23? I'm 23.
I'm 24 now.
Exactly. Like, I don't know. I thought Tobey Maguire's one was fine. Like, why do we have to keep redoing it?
Sam Raimi did a great job with the first two, at least.
I mean, I liked the Andrew Garfield reboot.
Did you?
Well, I just like him.
Okay.
And Emma Stone. And they were like dating and it was cute.
Yeah, it was
Didn't she
great.
Die?
Yeah, she like hit her head on a rock or something. But it doesn't, I don't, that's an interesting story in and of itself. Yeah. Is like the whole Sony Marvel thing.
Right.
But I just, the thing that I really don't understand is the role that franchises are playing in the, in a sort of, it's not a dying industry, but in the statistics have shown that the film industry, people are going to see movies less, whereas there are no shortage of these, you know, ever since Disney bought Marvel and Star Wars, there's no shortage of these huge blockbusters.
I know. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I don't understand.
Yeah. See, but I don't know. It's sad to me that admissions are down. Something just has to change to get people back in the theaters.
Right.
Maybe ticket prices could go down a little bit because that's freaking ridiculous.
That would be good. Yeah. But
I paid
that's
like $15 the other day for Spider-Man.
Was it 3D?
No.
Okay.
It was IMAX. And you know what? We almost left because of the sound. It sounded like they turned it all the way up on accident.
Too loud?
It was horribly loud.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
And I'm fine. Like, I go to concerts and, like, I'm fine with sound. But we were both, like, my boyfriend and I were both just like, what the hell? And it didn't get better. That was, like, not fun.
Yeah, I remember I saw Batman versus Superman. And it was just, on top of being kind of a bad, well, I'm going to go ahead and say a bad movie.
Yeah.
It was so loud, and there were just all those industrial noises, like that grating metal.
And there's a lot of that in Spider-Man, too.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I
rough.
Can't even imagine what Transformers sounds like. It's just like a horrible junkyard truck orgy.
It's bad. Ooh, that's a good band name.
Junkyard Truck Orgy?
Yes.
That's my new band name.
There
yeah.
you go. Tight. Punk band, maybe.
Thank you, Lise. Yeah, hopefully.
Maybe you can play at a DIY
space, which we'll be talking about soon. But
yes,
the real issue that the umbrage that I take with these three franchises battling it out in the top in this world where people are no longer going to the cinema as often, we saw films with smaller budgets outperforming these huge movies, at least in a proportional respect, certainly in some cases in an overall respect.
In an artistic respect.
And in an artistic respect, for sure. Like, Get Out, we talk about it all the time, but it's an anomalous film. It's an incredible movie, $4 million budget, over $100 million box office. The statistics are there. All of the statistics are there to support original filmmaking with smaller sets, smaller budgets, and you don't need to be hiring, like, Brad Pitt to shoot a bunch of zombies into nothingness, you know?
Right.
It just, I don't know. It's frustrating to see that. It's not learning its lesson.
I think it'll play out. You know, I think that the smaller, they'll rise. I don't know.
Rise of the Planet of the Apes?
Rise of the small indie movies of the apes.
Of the apes.
But I guess it remains to be seen because, well, I mean, and we were even talking about Disney a little before we started. It's just what they're remaking Mary Poppins.
Oh, yeah.
With Lin-Manuel Miranda, which I'm like, part of me is like, fuck yes.
Yeah.
But also,
why? Why?
The first one's so good, you know?
Yeah. And it's a classic.
It takes it out of the historical context and just like gives it a really big budget with nice cameras, and that's cool. But I don't know. I guess I'll. But then, see, I enjoyed Jungle Book.
Mm-hmm.
Loved Beauty and the Beast.
Yep.
Even Cinderella was good. It's pretty cool to see these animated movies come to life, but why can't we get some new stories going?
Right.
I mean, there's so many other people to talk about and things just, you know, portray on the screen. So Disney should lead by example.
Exactly. And I think that I know that Disney is probably listening to this. So,
take notes, Disney.
Take notes, Disney, because we're telling you your future here. And Disney.
Exactly.
Come on the show.
Yeah, we'd love to have you.
Yeah. Bringing it back to our hometown of Chicago, we have a great interview for you coming up here. after the break. We are going to be interviewing...
Wait, can you say that again? Sorry.
Yes. Okay. So just bringing it back to our hometown of Chicago, we've got a great interview here coming for you right after the break. We're interviewing Aaron Ska and Shay Hardacre from Octostash Production Company, who created the wonderful punk DIY web series called Collective Failures. And that is coming up next on this new episode of No Coast Cinema. Thank you, Lise, for joining me.
Thank you, Connor, for having me. I'm looking forward to the rest of the episode.
Yeah, are you ready for the break?
Oh, yeah. Let's
right.
do it.
All right, let's dive in. And we're back with No Coast Cinema, your guide to cinema here in Chicago as well as all around the world, exclusively through WGN Plus. I am your co-host, Connor Cornelius, and if you have been a regular listener, you will know that my co-host, Lise Graham, who has joined us again for her second consecutive week,
taking over,
is back. If you don't know Lise, she hosts her own podcast called Lise FM, which is fantastic. You should check it out. And today we are joined by two wonderful Chicago artists, Aaron Ska and Shay Hardacre. How are you guys doing today?
Hello.
Hi. We're doing pretty great.
Yeah.
And these are, you are two members of the collective Octostash Production, is that correct?
It's just Octostash Productions.
Octostash, okay.
Yeah, it's us two and then our best friend Kristen and our friend Jay that joined this year with us. So now we are producing stuff for people, which is kind of cool, I guess.
Yeah, and so obviously you guys are the show, well, Aaron is the show creator, director, and writer of the show that we're going to be talking about today, which is called Collective Failures, which is a documentary film. Well, it's the story of a documentary film graduate student documenting her and her oddball roommate's attempts to run and maintain a DIY music collective from their house. And as drama builds from the conflicting music scenes, comedy ensues, proving the task more difficult than previously thought.
It's such really, a good premise.
Yeah. It's really nice hearing you say it, too, like having it presented as such. Like, yeah, this
is a real
rad.
Thing.
Yeah.
You feel more professional when it sounds like that, because it's really like about complete crap show. Like that's, you know, just like the DIY culture.
And, yeah.
You know, I think Chicago in itself is like a huge drama scene filled with like a bunch of stuff with a lot of the different scenes. So it was really fun to like pick from the different scenes to write about, because I'm from a different, completely different scene than he's from. So it's been really fun to like him giving me stories from his specific like genre of music, and then me taking like the last 10 years of being in the DIY culture and like putting it into this. So it's been like really fun to just like put all of those stories of like the last 10 years of all the crazy stuff that happened and like make it into like an actual cohesive show.
And so you've been in the music scene of Chicago for about 10 years now.
10 years in Chicago, like 15, 16 years total. Like we're from Detroit originally, so Detroit has a really heavy like Chicago influence. A lot of the Chicago pop punk bands really made a mark in Detroit, and mm-hmm. that's kind of why I moved to the city, was I really wanted to feel the way these bands felt when they wrote a lot of this music, and it was just kind of just like diving into this culture.
That's interesting. And Shay, where are you from?
Also originally from Michigan. I've been here in Chicago for a little over 6 years. I had been somewhat a part of the music scene within the Detroit area, but moving here is what really, you know, kicked it up a notch. Being able to meet so many fantastic people that are involved in show spaces, with music, record labels. Chicago's scene is vast, and there is such a variety of genres and show spaces, and there's some great overlap that happens with a lot of these genres, but there is a huge divide between a lot of it. But being here, you know, meeting more people, becoming a part of music, and actually becoming a musician while I was here, doing vocals in a punk band, playing drums in a grindcore band. Now I do like solo electronic music, experimental stuff. And then living in a DIY show space, which is where most of Collective Failures was shot.
And Shay, beyond playing Milo on Collective Failures, you are also the sound designer for the show. Is that correct?
Yeah, I did a little bit. with season one, adding some extra sort of background music and helping facilitate finding extra bands to have music within it. And also just being sort of a creative consultant to Erin. She's a fantastic writer, but it's hilarious because I just kind of get to stand there and just tell stories about the ridiculous things that happen. And then that's how I just end up embodying characters and just, you know, pretending and playing,
yeah.
You know. Playing in the improv sense.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, there was a lot of times we'd be in our kitchen and we would pretend to be these characters when I was writing them and just like playing them out and seeing what worked and what didn't work a lot of the times, because you would take these stories and you didn't want to, you took them from real life, but there's also people in the scene that would get really like upset that you're taking their story, or so you had, there's the fine line between fiction and nonfiction of like, how do I take this person who is a curmudgeon in the scene and make a character out of him, but caricature him enough to where he knows it's not him, you know? So it was like that
awkward.
Yeah. It's like that fine line of just like, how do I make sure that this person knows that it's not them?
Let's talk about one of those situations. because the TV show that I'm writing, which, you know, just a pilot, all based in reality. Also, how do you fictionalize someone, and or how do they figure out that it's them?
Well, we had one person in particular that figured out that okay, so this one person in particular thought that he was the main character, Cliff. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't from me, it was from other people perceiving this character and like, you know, that guy, it reminds us of you. And he got really upset and I was like, look, I can't control how other people perceive you. Maybe you need to think about how you're perceived in the scene, and maybe you're not as nice as you might think you are. So it really is, you can't really control how people perceive it, so you have to really write how you feel, and if you feel like it's the right thing to do, then you just have to write it. Like, that's like, but I did for the second season, I tried to make Cliff more of a caricature and make him more humanized and not as brash and mean as he was in the first season. So I gave him a lot of humanistic qualities that maybe would separate him from this person. So you kind of, I would lay out all of the characteristics of this person that you're writing and say, okay, which one specifically that I really want to be in this character? And then you have to still have that like degree of separation. So there's a little bit of fiction that you have to bring in, but then there's still a little bit of truth. So it's this weird teeter-totter type of thing where you have to, like, level it out.
Totally.
But you're not going to make anybody happy, everybody happy, so that was something I really learned, that not everybody is going to like what you do, not everybody's going to be on board with it, so you can't worry about what other people think. You have to do what's right for you. And this show specifically is from my point of view. So everybody has a different perception of the scene, and this is just my story of mm-hmm. the scene. So whether they like it or not, I can't control it, but it's not going to stop me from writing what I want, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, don't ever, like, while you're writing your pilot, just write what you want and then go from there. Because if you limit yourself and worry about that, you're going to miss so many great things that you could write, you know, because you're in your head too much.
Thank you for that advice. Yeah. Sorry to take
over. No, that was great.
It was something I really learned, like, between first and second season of writing, of, like, that degree of separation.
But especially, you know, like, because we're sort of talking about these characters that exist in a DIY scene, there are almost tropes that exist in every DIY scene.
Right.
You know, there are the old curmudgeon-y guys. There are, like, especially because I can talk about my character. Like, people would probably watch the show and be like, hey, that just looks like Shay. It's just Shay being Shay. But I'm trying really hard to make this character a total goofball who's, like, way too excited about everything and just wants to be immersed and is, like, sort of oblivious to things going around him. So even as I, like, approach it, like, I mean, because I love doing characters, so I tried to approach it where he was this sort of, like, high-pitched, not necessarily squeaky, but he was, like, really excitable, like, hey, I'm Milo, hey, how's it going? How you guys doing? What's going on? Yeah, let's go to the show. You guys want to go to the show?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very, like, in his own head.
Yes, absolutely. And then in that regard, like, so then we have Cliff, who is their curmudgeon, who exists all over the place, because there's always people in music scenes that have been doing it for a while. They're a little jaded, but they still hold so much value, and they still have done so much great stuff to sort of help foster it. It's just, especially running a DIY space, eventually you're just like, okay, I'm getting tired of this.
It's exhausting. I did it for 2 years with two other people. I did like an acoustic space, the Castaway Collective, in my apartment years and years and years ago. And, you know, we were having shows three to four times a week, and that's exhausting, like, to have strangers in your house to, like, manage it, to all of the things that come down to it, because it's kind of like a little business, you know?
Yeah.
A business where you're not really getting paid, because a lot of the shows were free and you just donated to the bands, or places that do charge went to the band. Yeah. So it's, you're kind of being a little bit of a DIY entrepreneur, and if you've got other things going on, it takes a toll after a while.
What do you guys love about the DIY scene that you can't get from, you know, going to shows at, say, the Aragon or the Vic?
Oh,
what about it?
Well, it's a community. Like, it's you form friendships. It's more of an intimate setting. Like, you're really seeing people really work really hard at their music. Like, it's not sugar-coated. It's not, like, overly produced. It's people that are trying different things, especially in Shay's scene. He does a lot of, like, noise electronics. So it's, like, it's very out there. It's very different. And it's something that, you know, a lot of people don't know about. So you feel like you're in your own, like, little bubble and community, because a lot of people don't really know about people playing house shows in their basement. Like, when we did this show, people were like, what is this?
Especially family members.
Yeah, yeah. Like, our family members best. Were just, yeah, like, I had no idea that you did this. And
wow.
You know, a lot of, and I think, and, you know, it's funny because we kind of touch on that in season two, of just like the parents' perception of, like, we all have parents that don't understand. And they come to visit, or they come to shows, and they're just like, why are you doing this?
Which I'm so excited for you guys to be able to watch, because we had a wonderful actress, Jill. Do you remember, what's her last name?
I can't remember her last name off the top of my
head.
She
was a friend of Paul's from Second City, and she just did a tremendous job as this sort of, like, June Cleaver-esque, you know, motherly figure who's just trying to pamper, you know, Cliff and Bexley, and, like, ends up in the show at one, like, in a punk show, and is getting tossed around by everyone. So it's really fantastic to watch. And it's,
yeah,
very
so
funny.
Like, we touch on that, of just like how parents don't understand. You know,
parents,
have you ever had
understand.
That where, like, parents just don't get it, and, like, they think it's a hobby or it's fun, or, like, when are you going to grow up? And it's like, but this is grown up for,
yeah,
me. This is, you know, this is my thing.
So you're going to be getting some fresh eyes in this next season.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Like, this next season. So season one was really situational on, mm-hmm, the actual show space and how they run it. Season two, I wanted to dive into the characters specifically. Originally I had 10 page scripts for the first season.
Okay.
This next season I had 15 plus page scripts. Usually, when you film, a script page equals 1 minute of screen time, but if it's mostly dialogue heavy, it's going to be shorter than that.
Okay.
So a 10 page script for us in the first season was maybe 6 minutes on time, so we had a lot of room to work with for second season. So I really dove into these characters and, like, their relationships and how they react with each other in like how they live with each other and how they live with other people in the scene, because there are different houses that don't like each other in real life, and
really,
people that have, yeah, like, that people don't like each other, they have vendettas against each other, that they really pit each other against each other. So that the whole second season is something happens, bad things keep happening to the Fishbowl Collective,
mm-hmm,
and they can't figure out who it is and why it's happening. So it's
like
this,
what kind of bad things?
So, like, their show calendar that they have, like, someone changes the dates on it.
That no one uses
that
besides
no one
Bexley.
Uses. Yeah, that Bexley. So Bexley's, like, freaking out because she's like, oh, my God, this band emailed me and they said they'll be here at this time, but they're not on the show calendar. Like, so someone's, like, completely messing with their schedule.
Yeah.
Somewhat, like, they have electrical problems in their house because obviously they live in a crap hole, so it's not exactly the most up-to-date in code. So they have, like, lighting issues. They have a scathing review that comes out in a DIY zine that, like, completely just demoralizes them in every sense of the word, like, personally. And she's like, who is writing these things? So they go on this mission to try to figure out who is messing with them, because they're literally, their livelihood is at stake, because obviously this is Cliff's everything.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so he's really, Cliff kind of takes this goofy, like, he takes Milo's detective gear and he goes on this mission to try and find out who is doing, so he's like,
which
following
was a fun, like,
people.
Role reversal, because
yeah,
in season one Milo is, like, trying to be this detective sleuth to see, like, what's Bexley up to, who's she seeing,
yeah,
what is this, and now Cliff dons that persona to then try and find out who's, like, sabotaging their collective space.
So this season two is more of, like, a continuous story. Season one is more of, like, is more episodic, where you can kind of watch them out of order.
You're hitting the themes of what it is to be a part of the DIY community.
Yeah. Without like ever having to like explain it. I think that was something that we talked about even before we started doing it, because we're like, yes, people aren't going to know what a crust punk is. People aren't going to understand what punk time is. And essentially that was the first episode, to try and set it up and just give a comedic spin on it. But because the DIY music scene is such a underground, and I hate even using that term, I'm using air quotes with this, thing that I guess mainstream society wouldn't understand it or know much about it, but we don't want to sit there and literally talk to people and tell them what it is, because I feel like that's just sort of taking a less importance on what it is to us, because this is what we love. This is literally what we love to do. And so we just wanted to, or Aaron essentially just wanted to make something that had these characters exist in it, and that was fun and entertaining for people to watch, without feeling like we had to like talk down and like state,
patronize,
like, what
yeah.
It's a show, don't tell kind of approach.
Yeah, exactly. That's, I mean, that's the big thing in writing that you learn, is that you're to show, not to tell.
Yeah.
And that was like a challenge with this world that no one really knows about. So it's like when you write a fantasy, like Game of Thrones, it's its own entity, and like it has its own world. It has no rules. It has none of that. No one knew anything about it. So they literally had to show this world in a very specific way to get people to understand it and like have everything weave together. So that was definitely season two for me, of like, how do I use the space and the DIY scene as a backdrop to these characters living in it? And these characters are older. They're not like, Milo's like 23 in it, but like Bexley and Cliff is like 35. Bexley is 28. They're older. They're people where you would think that they would be married, have children, settled down. A lot of the people in the scene aren't like that. I'm 31. I'm not married. I don't want children. I don't want to own a home. So like it's showing that alternative lifestyle. And It touches on the character's need to, like, when is it time to grow up? You know, like, that is something that Bexley faces, is, like, when do I grow up? When do I walk away? When do I get the grown-up job? When do I find my place? And, you know, a lot of the characters, we see them grow a lot. Like, Milo gets a girlfriend for the first time, and she's a dominatrix goth girlfriend. Just hilarious.
A lot of fun to shoot that stuff. That's for sure.
I can only imagine.
And the actress Masha is a wonderful woman, and we had so much fun with her. And she's a good friend of ours, but she played the character very well.
And like Cliff's mom comes to visit, so that kind of sets the tone for like that. Something.
That's the actress Jill that I was saying. The mom that's in
and,
the episode.
Oh, okay.
And and Bexley, she tries to fit into like. Into the scene, because she's kind of the mother of everything. You know, she kind of runs everything, and she tries to find her place in being with Felix in a relationship out in the open and not afraid anymore. And, you know, so it's interesting and funny all at the same time.
So you'll be building out the world a little bit more in this second season.
Yes.
And that was something that, honestly, to borrow that sort of concept of world building that you mentioned, I was really impressed with, even though it was an episodic thing where you're just sort of introducing people to the themes of the DIY punk scene. By the end of the season, it's the other collective, right?
Mm-hmm.
You see that it's not just this one, you know, it's not just a fishbowl. It's not, you know, it's not just like glass on all sides. It's a full world. And so it's cool to hear that you guys in the second season will be opening that up a little bit. But I really wanted to get down to what was the reason behind, like, why did you want to capture, obviously you're very passionate, both of you are very passionate about the underground, air quotes, DIY scene, but what was the, like, driving passion that led both of you maybe together, or that led you specifically, Aaron, into writing it?
So when, January of last year, I started taking a class at Second City, and I had been writing for a while, and I think it was like 5 years ago, I decided I wanted to be a television writer. I was just like, well, shoot, I think this is what I should do with my life. And he's like, what? What? Oh my God, you are a photographer. I don't understand. I've never read any of your writing, because I was very secretive about my writing for a long time. And, you know, I showed him my writing. He was like, this is amazing. So I started taking classes at Second City, and I wrote a different show for something different that I'm passionate about, fixed gear bicycles. And I wrote a story about a schizophrenic woman and her talking bicycle, which those are two things I have very close to my heart. My aunt is schizophrenic, so I know that world very well. So after I wrote that, my teacher was like, you need to write something that you know, another thing that you know that you can do to put yourself out there. And I'm like, I'm so into the other project. I'm like, I can't even think straight. And it was the last day of class. It was Valentine's Day. We're at dinner. And he's complaining about something at his house, the DIY house that he lives in. He's telling me this ridiculous story. And it's just like, instead of being romantic, it hit me like a ton of bricks. Oh, my God, I need to write about this. And it just it was one of those aha moments for me. And it was like, how did I not come up with this sooner? This is my life. Why am I not writing about this that no one knows anything about? There's no other show out there that's like this.
But it was funny because our little romantic date immediately just turned into us just shooting off ideas and just getting like super creative and just being like, oh, this is awesome. And then I'm just immediately being like, well, there's this story and then there's this story and there's this story. And it's just like, I have so many
and
stories
for you. It literally just kind of blossomed from that. And then it just kind of snowballed. And I literally wrote that first season in a week.
Wow.
And it was it just literally came out
very
of me.
Fast, yeah.
And it's 10-minute episodes.
So it's 10-page episodes that I wrote.
So it didn't really turn out to 10 minutes, but
or how many episodes in a season?
5 for the first season, 6 for the second season.
Okay,
I went a little crazy and added an extra episode for the heck of it.
But then we also have season 3, which is 4 episodes.
Which I also wrote a season 3, which we shot at the same time as season 2.
Okay.
So
that's coming out.
That's coming out in like January probably.
Okay, cool.
Because we were losing our DIY space that we actually shoot in.
Yeah.
So I was like, all right, I have to bust this out.
Dang.
And write. I literally wrote season 3 in 4 days. I don't know how I did
it. It's like the time crunches of like real Hollywood, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Like, I don't know how I did it.
Well, I'm interested in the web series phenomenon and these shorter episodes. But you talk about the characters, like there's just so much depth there. How do you fit it all into 10 minutes? And how is that different? I know it must be like really impossibly hard. How do you think it's different than like half hour show, or how is it similar? I'm sure there's like,
well, with web series, so half hour shows, there's usually an A and a B storyline, sometimes a C storyline if you get lucky. With a web series, you can have an A and a B storyline, which we did have, but you can't have any buffer. So usually how there's a build to things, there's more of a sequence. Like the inciting incident has to happen immediately, like in the cold open, in that first teaser before the credits roll. So it's like you have to set the world up incredibly fast. So you have to pull out the filler a lot. So that was something that for me, I really had to like look at. Like I watched a lot of sketch comedy, because sketch comedy will help, because they do whole scenes in 2 to 3 minutes, and they go from point A to point Z within 2 minutes. So they completely establish the world that you're in, and that's a really good thing to look at. To like figure out how to make a, because the web series is kind of a step up from sketch, and then from that goes the half an hour and then to the hour, you know, long shows. So for me, it was really like getting to the point and making it very punchy very fast. So it's there was a lot of dialogue that had to be to the point. Like there was no mulling around. You had to make these scenes, you had to put them in the scenes already. Like you had to put them in the situation and then run from there. So like a lot of the times when in the first season, a lot of the times, you know, I made it a mockumentary, so it felt like the cameras could kind of be around at any given time, and you could talk to the camera, and talking heads, like the interviews, were really helpful because that helped move the story along. That filled in the gaps where you couldn't show it because you had such a small time frame. So when you do a web series, you think about that kind of stuff. What can you put in there that will move the story along with the least amount of time possible?
How many people are involved in, you know, all of it? Like the actors and the shooting and the sound and the
so
editing.
The first season was really DIY. Like I did a lot of it myself. I was literally 10 departments. I literally did everything from costumes to catering was all mine.
I like
so,
how you put it that way. From costumes to catering.
Like I literally,
I'm going to start a side business.
From C to C.
Yeah.
From C to C. Like, so the first season there was maybe 10 of us. The second season we're teetering between 20 to 30 people.
Wow.
That helped.
Yep.
And the really, so this is the big point to put across, is that it's a completely DIY down to like what we do behind the scenes. Every single person involved in this is some way in the DIY community.
Cool.
Or they're in the improv community at Second City. Like a lot of the actors were actually from my improv troupe. So I literally could pull them right from the potato farmers that I perform with and be like, I'm going to put you as this character. And no one got paid. So everybody donated their time for free. That was something about a micro budget production that if you want to do, you can do it. Like, it is possible. Like, the first season was done on $500, and that was including buying a crappy camera.
Yeah.
Like, that was what we did it on.
And this, the first season, like, I love talking to people about it, because as people kind of get into it and they see what we're doing now, there's a very large step up in quality. We have a wonderful camera operator, cinematographer, and now editor, Jay, who has, you know, a far better camera than we did. We were using, like, a Canon Vixia, like, HD camcorder. So it didn't work well in low light, which we were shooting, you know, indoors pretty much at all times. So the first season, it has a amateurish look. But I love talking about it because it's like, we just did it. If you have an idea and you want to do it, just do it. And it's the way I approach, especially when it comes to like noise and experimental music. I have people that ask, like, how do you get into this? How do you start doing it? I'm like, just do it. You know, they're like, what gear do you use? I was like, dude, just grab a microphone and a brick and just start recording that. Like, I don't care. Just start making noise. If you want to do it, make it. And it's the same thing with television or anything creative. We did it, you know, like Aaron said, on a $500 budget. We had a friend, you know, come. We bought like a simple boom mic and like a Zoom H4N kind of thing to get audio, which we actually ended up not being able to use. But we just used the means that we had. And that's why we're so excited now to be able to have a little bit higher quality so that people, because we live in a day and age where, like, you know, like 4K HD is like a thing. So
yeah,
now people get to watch and be like, this looks awesome.
It's, you know, the first season we didn't have a lot of backing because the scene is very fickle. Like, I don't know if you know anything about the punk scene, but they're very fickle. They're not going to jump on board with something if they don't have something tangible to see. After we made the first season, we had so many bands that wanted to be in it that I actually had to turn people away because I didn't have enough episodes for the amount of bands that wanted to be in it. So,
right.
Which was really exciting for me that they were willing to bring all of their gear and play two songs just to be in the show and be immersed in this world.
That's sweet.
You know, and there were so many people in the scene that wanted to be extras, that we had so many people that came that I didn't even know them. So I was like getting freaked out of like having all of these people in my space and not and directing people I had no idea who they were.
It sounds sort of like a microcosm of the DIY punk scene.
Absolutely.
Anyway.
Yeah,
like, it really,
it is,
I mean,
inside itself kind of thing.
And that's what we kind of pride ourselves on. So it's, you know, you're writing a pilot right now. You're getting into the web series. Just do it. Like, we had $1,500 for season 2 and 3. That's all that we had. And we had a fundraiser that we had where a bunch of the bands that were going to be in the show played. And Old Style ended up sponsoring us too, so we didn't have to cover any of the beer cans this next season. We didn't have to tape the beer cans. We could actually have them in there, because obviously
great.
Old Style is like the epitome, like, beer drink of choice in the DIY community
of Chicago,
specifically.
Yeah.
So, you know, it
how did
grows.
You go about getting that sponsorship?
So, my friend Sam actually is like one of like their spokespeople, and he's in the band called Space Blood, and they played in the second season. So he like hooked that up for us, and like
tight.
We had
which
like the fundraiser that
saying.
Raised enough money to like give us really great costumes, and we built a freaking haunted house. Like, we built walls and made a haunted house inside of the show space for season 2.
Yeah.
So like that's
not to mention a really fun tiki episode.
Yeah. So cool. Yeah. So like, festive. Yeah.
Yes.
So like, if you really want to do this, you can do it. Like, there are people at Second City, especially. You put the word out, people will come and help you. I'm actually helping someone else out from Second City work on her web series and, like, get her started. So, like, it's so possible.
I'll keep your number, girl.
So, the first season of Collective Failures was released on July 31st of 2016.
Yes.
How has the reception been for the show? Because I assume, just knowing people from the scene, I've shown a few people and they love it.
Yeah, I think the punk community in itself really enjoyed it. Like, the pop punk community really liked it, because obviously it's funny, different genres have different senses of humor. I always find I'm in the pop punk scene and they always seem to have a pretty good sense of humor. They can make fun of themselves. Some of the other scenes are a little bit more like,
yeah,
they're
too
like,
serious.
They're a little too serious. They're like, you're making fun of noise music. I'm like, not really. I mean, if you think about it, all music is kind of silly in itself. Like, don't take yourself too seriously.
Right. Noise is the silliest.
Yeah, like,
I mean, because we had a character in season 1 who's just brandishing a machete,
yeah,
which is actually based on a friend and a favorite noise musician of myself who has played sets where he essentially puts a microphone onto the machete and uses that as an instrument. So although noise, punk, grind, hardcore, whatever you want to say, is very serious in itself, and usually people talk about very serious things, which is amazing, it's still hilarious.
Yeah. So, I mean, there was a lot of people that, like, embraced it. But there was some people that were like, you're being very detrimental to the scene. You're exposing us. People are going to get curious, like, because there's that underlying issue that it is illegal to have shows in your basement. Like, that is,
yeah,
that is an illegal
thing.
Does
that ever come into the show?
It does. The second season, like, there's second and third season, it's very evident that, like, there's an ominous loom to things of, like, if we keep doing this, we could get caught.
And what's illegal about it?
We have to have a permit to do that kind of thing, to play live music. And then also people have, you know, beer and that kind of stuff. So it's really kind of, you're like running an illegal kind of sport.
Right.
Also,
you're not carting people.
Yeah.
No.
Like,
but it's also like they're, yeah, essentially venues would be paying taxes to have live music. And of course, everything is about money. So obviously the city of Chicago gets no money from DIY shows, which is essentially where it would come from. But I think we do talk about it because at some point they kind of talk about other venues getting shut down, DIY venues, which has happened. I know that there's some in Baltimore, and then we had the unfortunate trauma with Ghost Ship in California.
What happened there?
There was actually a DIY warehouse space that had caught on fire.
Oh, that's right.
Yes.
And that happened right when I was writing season two, so I would, like, people were really nervous. We waited on season two a little bit to start filming because I didn't want to, like, start.
Rush it.
Yeah, because, like, it was bringing a lot of heat and a lot of, like, people were getting shut down everywhere because of it, and it was making me nervous whether or not I could continue to write about it in that way.
Depending on what the
spectrum of what was going on. And I feel like season two, a lot more people are going to see it just because the quality is insane. Like, it's, like, we're doing rough edits right now, and it's, like, you're going to, like, freak out. Like, it's just so good. Like, I can't
very
even
excited for it.
Like,
yeah.
I can't
Italian
even
finger
like
kiss.
It's just it's so good. So, you know, we're really excited about it, and then hopefully more people will see it eventually. I mean, season three is the end. Like, I did a full story and season three ends it, because we're moving to LA next year, so it's kind of like the end. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Awesome.
So chasing the dream.
Are you like,
yeah, there you go.
You're like,
yep, moving. Like,
yeah.
I'm
me
doing
too.
Yeah, I'm doing that's the awesome thing. Like, I'm ready to do it. So this was like the end of that, like, my legacy leaving in Chicago. But I would love it if someone like Hulu or Netflix saw it and saw the potential and picked it up, and then we could redo it, all of it, and be amazing.
Yeah, with all that network backing, right?
Yeah,
there.
Like, if just the network backing of being able to make these characters even more rich and more, like, just more dive deep into, like, this culture that no one knows anything about. So hopefully, fingers crossed, that season two will hit the mark with that, and fingers crossed on it.
People will like it and enjoy it and watch it and share it around.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, well, I thought it was great. I think it does a fantastic job of capturing the DIY punk scene in Chicago. It feels very Chicago. From Collective Failures and Octostash Production, we have Aaron Ska and Shay Hardacre, and we will be back very soon with our C segment, where we're going to be talking a little bit about our favorite movies and how music interacts with those and informs our experience. Heading into the break, we got No Coast Cinema, only on WGN+. Hey! We're back with No Coast Cinema. I'm your co-host, Connor Cornelius, joined again by Lise Graham for the second consecutive week.
I know.
And then we also have, from Octostash Production, creators of the show Collective Failures, we have Aaron Ska and we have Shay Hardacre. How are you guys doing?
Hello.
We're good.
Back from the break.
Yes, thanks again for having us here.
So with this segment, we're going to be talking a little bit about movies and how the music interacts with these films and of our favorite movies and how they sort of inform our viewing experience. So, Lise, do you have an idea?
Oh, God. I mean,
do you have one idea?
Okay. Well, Baby Driver, obviously, because I just saw it. And it's like the epitome of a car music movie. I mean, have you guys seen it?
Not yet.
It's on. Yeah.
Oh, you're gonna love it.
We have friends who are like, you have to see it. Yeah,
it's so good. I saw it the day it came out. I didn't know anything about it. I actually had heard about it through one of my favorite podcasts, Comedy Bang Bang. They were interviewing John Hamm and then Edgar Wright. And it was funny because they were like, so this is the sequel to Boss Baby, right?
When I heard the title, I was like, is that what it is? Because that's immediately I think about,
for
like,
sure.
Boss
that's
Baby driving a car.
Yeah, right. But no. So, well, have you seen it?
I have not yet, but I'm going to.
You guys.
I know.
Killing me. Well, it's...
I know.
I don't want to give anything away, but if you've seen the trailer or if you've heard about it, it's amazing. It's the editing is just phenomenal. It's all synced up to the music. They had like an editor on site, so they would do rough edits like every day after the end of shooting. It's just
like amazing. in real time.
Yeah, it's insane. So there's one. I mean, but I've been watching musicals since I was a little kid. My dad is he's a musician, but he's also, we're all, you know, big musical fans. So it was, you know, Singing in the Rain, Summer Stock, My Fair Lady, Sound of Music from the age of 4. So I've, you know, seen it in that. And then like that plays out to Across the Universe and then of La La Land, which I'm a huge fan of. And I know not everybody in this room is.
Yeah, that was a little bit of a controversial movie at the Grammys this year, wasn't it?
I really loved that movie. I just didn't like the ending. I was really sad about the ending.
Yeah,
the ending
okay.
really.
Good.
Like,
I'm glad you liked most of it.
Most of it was great. I felt with how cinematic it was and how like old movie, like old style movie yeah. that it was, that it would have that like cinematic ending that
right.
I wanted. And I
happily
was like,
ever after.
I was like, you got to be kidding me.
I think it was kind of like Damien being like, twist, it's today, modern day. And then he gives you the whole 10-minute ballet where it's like, everything's good. They're actually together. My mom was like really confused. She was like, wait, what? Did they end up together? Or
I ended up pulling the. I watched it only a couple weeks ago in Boston when I was visiting a friend. And I actually, in the middle of it, I pulled up the script because I wanted to see how he wrote
cool.
it all out, because I was just like enamored with
ooh.
Like these like very like theatrical scenes, like in the dancing and
yeah.
the floating. I'm like, how are you writing? How are you describing
well,
this?
Are you imagining that?
Yeah, like
yeah.
how are you putting this like from script to screen is so different. It's like, how do you describe that
right.
in a five sentence block? Like,
and
was enamored with
that's
it.
That's the cool thing about his story. I don't know how much you know about it, but like he wanted to do La La Land like years ago.
Yeah,
you know,
he, like,
he's been sitting on it forever. And he couldn't get funding. And then finally, I mean, look at it. It's done a lot, whether you like it or not. But yeah, I don't know. I could keep going. Almost like soundtrack wise, Almost Famous is great.
It's hard to fit into such a small time frame.
Okay,
I'll give that one to you.
While we let Erin think maybe a little bit more about what her choice would be. Shay, did you mention that you?
Oh yeah,
had one
I mean, I could go on and on. I mean, you know, being a musician and I really love synth scores. So first off the bat would be John Carpenter.
Okay,
he sort of revolutionized the idea of very minimal synth scores for horror, thriller, you know, action films. And actually, one of my favorites might not be a huge favorite, but I love the Fog's soundtrack. It's very, very ominous. I really love the sort of marine sort of found sound that comes out of it, very simple piano melodies. And I saw John Carpenter play Talia Hall when he was doing a tour supporting his records, which are also great. And it was a mind-blowing experience. But then on top of that, the Vangelis' score for Blade Runner is
totally.
Absolutely amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Did you see the trailer for Blade Runner 2?
Yes, I actually can't wait. I think it's going to be amazing.
I can't wait.
Yeah.
It looks... I mean, and Ryan Gosling joining the... Oh. Wow. It's like La La Land plus Blade Runner.
Yeah. I could stare at him all day.
Oh, yeah.
But that score is wonderful. And then even more modern scores. Kyle Dixon and I can't remember the other guy... who is of the synth group Survive, who did the Stranger Things soundtrack.
Okay, yeah.
Blew up what the idea of sort of synth-based soundtracks were. I feel like... Afterwards, I was seeing hundreds of BuzzFeed articles of, if you like Survive, you would like this. And it's just like tons of artists that I'm like, yeah, these guys are all amazing.
Michael Stein, is it?
Michael Stein, yes.
Yeah.
Thank
what
you.
Is it about sort of semi-scary movie? I mean, obviously, John Carpenter did more pure horror, but Stranger Things, it's got horror elements. There's a synth soundtrack in It Follows by Disaster
that was going to be the next
which
one.
I thought
yep.
was great.
Incredible. The score for that is amazing. It Follows is such a modern piece of horror. But it's the somewhat of the 80s nostalgia that I
yeah.
think comes from synth, especially when I know that these producers are using really vintage equipment, which have these really warm analog tones, which create what I think is like a true sense of dread, you know? Like I think with these sort of synth scores, you get more emotional feeling. But even on top of that, like there's tons of great music. I mean, even Carpenter did like, you know, sort of like krautrock, you know,
yeah.
jammy type stuff.
Sure.
Like Assault on Precinct 13, like the main score for that is a great sort of guitar-driven track. But yeah, I love all that. The Drive score is also really great and the songs that they have on that. I really, really love the soundtracks of films that use like sort of that 80s nostalgia of like synth and synth pop.
Yeah, and Drive, I think Drive really does a good job of making it feel cool when you're, it captures how cool you feel when you're driving late at night.
Oh, yeah.
In a car, like, blasting your music.
Because I use, like, Kavinsky's Night Call, which he's also just, like, sort of a great, you know, like, synth, kraut rock type dude. And that track's awesome, and it gives you that feeling of, like, watching the street lights go past and driving a car with little leather gloves and, like, you know, the headlights and the lights of your, like, very neon, you know.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. Synth and neon, why does that go? It's just 80s, I guess.
It's just 80s. It just became, like, something that just clicked. But, like, I love it. I love that aesthetic. I love the way it looks.
Yes.
You know, I love stuff like that.
Aaron, did you recover from the from Lisa's theft?
I'm still going to say Almost Famous, but I have another one, too. So music really drives my life. Like, I grew up on music, and I'm a musician, classically trained musician. I can play just about anything. And, you know, for me, music is an escape. And it also is something for me of I listen to music to inspire scenes. Like, I actually, when I write stuff, I listen to specific songs that actually make these scenes come to life. And I think a lot of, you know, movies have that quality. Like, Almost Famous, like Cameron Crowe. Oh, my God. Like, that movie for me, with that soundtrack and the way that it's an autobiographical of his life as when he, you know, wrote for Rolling Stone and he, you know, he traveled with these bands.
Oh,
and
it's so good.
It's so good. And just like that, you feel like you're in that time. Like,
yeah.
And I felt like, for me, I just feel like I lived in the wrong time. Like, the music of the 70s, like, is just everything to me. Like, I grew up at that. Like, the Eagles, like, I literally dated my first boyfriend because he looked like Bob Seger. Like, that is how much I loved. Like, I just, that music back then, you really had to have real talent. There was no fixing it in the studio. You had to have it. And when you, you know, that you kind of, Elton John, too, like, you know, that, all of that stuff, this really, like, the way that you use music in film makes, can make or break a scene, and it gives you, it makes a feeling. And I do that when I write too. And Guardians of the Galaxy was probably the most known one today that made me feel like that. That soundtrack, like, and the way that the director does, like, I read on how he kind of, like, how he got to where he was. He just culminates music. Like, he just has, like, giant playlists that he just keeps saving and he goes through, and I do the same thing.
I want to follow him on Spotify.
Yeah, like, I like, I do the same thing too. I have tons of music that I save for specific things, and it's, I love that. Like, even Kevin Smith in a lot of his movies too, like, Mallrats had a really great soundtrack, and it was really, like, kooky and funny, and it played with a lot of ridiculousness that came along with it. And I've always been a big fan of his work and the way he, like, you know, molds it together. But yeah, like, music, oh, just almost, I love it. It's just, it makes you feel a certain way, and that's the way movies are supposed to make you feel. So it's definitely come on to me with that.
And it can even go so far as to inform, like, inspiration for even writing a movie in general. It doesn't have to be like, oh, here's a song, and I think this would fit perfectly here with Baby Driver. I haven't seen it, but I'm an Edgar Wright fan, so I listened to an interview with him where he said that, like, in the late 90s, he listened to this song from the Blues Explosion, and he was like, wow, this embodies Car Chase. I want to write a movie around that.
Yeah.
And I just think that that's a fascinating thing, how a movie that even something like The Lord of the Rings could be, it's like a sumptuous visual feast, you know? But then Howard Shore's soundtrack to it is my personal favorite part of it, because I just like listening to it. It brings me into the world, like the synth in the horror. It brings you back. It takes you somewhere.
Yeah.
And I just think that is, it's like a transcendental thing about music that's paired with a visual medium. I don't understand how it works.
It's all auditory, visual, like, it's the way that, you know.
I mean, it can inspire so many different things. Like, I wrote, my other show that I wrote specifically is based off of music. This girl hears music along with her talking bike, and she thinks that this music, actually, the lyrics of the music that she sees on billboards and whatever, she thinks that, like, it's telling her something. And so, like, it actually drives the story to where the story could go next. So, like, the viewers could literally start collecting the soundtrack and try to figure out what happens next. So, like, there's this level of, like, taking these music to another level and putting it into writing and making it, like, with, like, Baby Driver. Like, when I heard about that, I was like, I have something similar that I'm working on. This is a little bit more, like, you know, to the beat,
like,
but, like, mine's
aspect,
more like,
yeah.
Mine's more story based, but it's still like that using it to make something so visual is awesome. in that way. And it's kind of exploding. That's which I love.
Yeah, totally.
Well, Aaron, writer, creator of Collective Failures, where can we watch your show?
You'll be able to watch it on our YouTube channel, Collective Failures, or collectivefailures.com. You can also follow us at Collective Failures TV on Instagram. I do a lot of Instagram updates on stuff that's going on. The first season is up on the website. The second season, we're hoping by the end of August, early September, we'll have a premiere date. I think we're going to do it at Township with Cinema Obscura.
Awesome.
So,
friends of the show.
Yep. If you guys follow us on Facebook or Instagram, there'll be updates for like a big viewing party for that. So, and our promo video is coming out next week, and then a full trailer a couple weeks after that. So it's almost time for it to happen.
It's about to pull the curtain back.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, Aaron, Shay, thank you guys so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank
it's
you so much.
Amazing talking to people who are clearly so passionate about what they're doing, especially with something that's so near and dear to my heart as the DIY punk scene in Chicago. And Lise, thank you again for joining and
my
being
pleasure.
The mastermind behind everything. Thank you so much.
Hardly. You are the mastermind this week. I'm just the co-pilot.
We're just a little bit lost without our beloved host, Tom Hush. But to borrow one of his lines, again, thank you guys for coming on the show.
Thank you.
This has been NoCo Cinema. Good morning, good evening, and good night.